We have different amounts of diversity in the two states we talked to. California is famously diverse, people of many colors and national origins and faiths. Oregon is a bit less diverse, in part due to its creation as a state where people with brown skin simply were not allowed to live at the beginning. Laws change, but demographics change more slowly. We'll focus on Jews in Oregon in this hour. Not a big portion of the population, but as our guest demonstrates, a significant portion. Ellen Eisenberg is the author of The Jewish Oregon Story, 1950 to 2010. Ellen is a professor of American history at Willamette University in Salem, and she's the author of several other books. This book is a sequel to Embracing a Western Identity, Jewish Oregonians, 1849 to 1950. Ellen Eisenberg, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So take us back to the earlier book. How influential were Jews in early Oregon, and for that matter, how persecuted were they?
Well, surprisingly, more the former than the latter, really. And that's one of the most interesting things, I think, about what I've called in the second book, The Jewish Oregon Story. Jews came early on with all the other pioneers and took pride in being pioneers. And because they got in on the ground floor, so to speak, there weren't structures already in place. They weren't integrating into an already established society. And so that meant that things were much more open to them than was the case in many places back east.
The Jewish population now, just under 1% of the state total, I notice. How does that compare with the historical levels?
It's actually about in the same ballpark. It's varied from a little bit less than 1% up, pushing up toward close to 2 or just under. It's also, of course, a little bit difficult to count. We, in the U.S. Census, of course, there is no religion question. And so how to count Jewish populations is a subject that's much debated.
Oh, interesting. So what are some of the methods? Do you know?
Well, there have been several recent studies. There's something called the Jewish Population Survey that's done about every 10 years. And that traditionally, if we go back 30, 40, 50 years, tended to count based on Jews who were affiliated with some sort of communal institution. And so they counted, especially for smaller towns and so on. They would call the local synagogue and say, you know, how many Jews do you believe that you have there? Later, it went to more sophisticated sampling techniques. But even with that, it's still difficult because there are many people who identify as Jewish and who might not be religious. And so it depends a little bit on what you're trying to count, the number of people who identify as Jewish culturally or ethnically, or the number who are actually practicing Jews in some religious way.
Yeah, you can get some different numbers that way, certainly. This project involved what was the Oregon Jewish Museum. It's got a longer name now. Tell us about the purpose and the name change.
Sure. It actually had an even earlier incarnation as the Jewish Historical Society of Oregon. And over time, it became the Oregon Jewish Museum, which for a while was a museum without walls. In other words, they had archives and they launched exhibits, but in other facilities. They didn't have their own. Over the last 15 or so years, they've had a series of facilities and are now actually moving into a new location in Portland. On the North Park blocks. They'll be opening in the spring. About 2 years ago, they merged with the Oregon Center for Holocaust, and so it's become a longer name.
Oregon Jewish Museum
and Center for Holocaust Education.
You write of being a little reluctant to follow the earlier book with this one. What was the reluctance?
Well, originally I was going to write one book that had a single post-war chapter, and most of my historical research has pretty much ended at about World War II, so I hadn't done much work on recent history in my own writing. The other piece of that was that when I was approached by a group at the Oregon Jewish Museum and asked to do this book because the earlier group, the Oregon Jewish Historical Society, had commissioned a book by a historian named Stephen Lowenstein that went up to 1950. And so they wanted something to follow that. And I wasn't particularly interested in writing a sequel to Lowenstein's book, which is a fine book and I use all the time, but it was a different kind of approach than I was interested in. They encouraged me to go at it in my own way. And it ended up in some ways being a sequel both to my own book and to Lowenstein's book.
And Ellen, you're right. You worked to make this not a Portland-centric work. How far-flung are Jews in Oregon?
Well, that was easier to do for the first book than for the second, frankly. It's interesting. We've come full circle. I'm thinking about your particular audience in Southern Oregon. So the very first Jewish service in Oregon took place in Jacksonville. And there was quite a thriving merchant community in Jacksonville in the wake of the gold rush in the 1850s. And that was true of many, many small towns all around the state in the mid to late 19th century. As we get into the 20th century, a lot of those smaller Jewish communities ceased to exist. They either people moved into Portland or the communities kind of assimilated into the general community. And there really wasn't that much of a presence in some of those more far-flung places for a number of decades in the 20th century. And then in the last few decades, we've seen a bit of a revival. There are several congregations, for example, in Ashland.
It's interesting to think of it in those terms, though, that there was a presence and then it faded away and then it's been restored.
Yes.
All right. So yes. We're talking to Ellen Eisenberg about her book, The Jewish Oregon Story, 1950 to 2010. It tracks the progress of Jews in Oregon and their influence, their increasing influence through that time, politically, culturally, you name it. Much more to talk about with Ellen Eisenberg. We'll take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us when we come back from a break. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Ellen Eisenberg, Professor of American History at Willamette U in Salem. She's the author of a book called The Jewish Oregon Story, 1950 to 2010, tracking the progress of Jews culturally, economically, politically, you name it, since World War II, primarily since World War II. And you can join the conversation on the exchange. You might have questions to share or stories to share as well. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So Chapter 1 opens in 1971 with the opening of the Jewish Community Center in Portland. What is the significance of that event?
Well, one of the things I found in doing this research on the post-war period was that that late 1960s, early 1970s was a huge turning point. And I already knew that that was the case for American Jews in general, that many authors point to that, both because of the Six-Day War, which really changed the Jewish community's orientation to focus much more heavily on Israel. And many historians point to that period as a time when Jewish communities kind of turned inward. They had been very involved in the civil rights movement. And during that period of time, there's a radicalization that takes place during this, at the end of the 1960s. There seems to be a bit of a shift in the Jewish community. And in Portland, what I found was that what was going on the national level was true as well, but also in Portland, there was a major shift because the old historic Jewish neighborhood in South Portland was raised for urban renewal in that period in the late 1960s. And so there's a shift of institutions, of population, and so on. And that comes at a moment when Jews are really experiencing an unprecedented acceptance. And so as they're building the JCC, they're really trying to work out what sort of Jewish suburban life is going to look like and how does one maintain the source of identity in a situation where you are really fully accepted in society?
Was South Portland, in that context, pretty much a Jewish enclave?
Well, that's interesting. It's remembered by many people in that way, and that's very typical of memories of these sorts of ethnic neighborhoods. You could point to the Lower East Side in New York. In actuality, those neighborhoods tended to be much more mixed, and this was the case with South Portland as well. So Italians tend to remember it as an Italian neighborhood, for example.
Oh.
It was sort of the neighborhood where many immigrants clustered, and so it was a much more diverse neighborhood than many of the others in Portland. And there was a very heavy Jewish presence there, yes.
I ask the question because of other people who have noted that urban renewal tends to displace ethnic neighborhoods primarily.
Yes. Ethnic neighborhoods historically have often been equated with blighted neighborhoods. in need of renewal. And of course, this was a point in Portland history when renewal essentially meant raising a neighborhood and putting in office buildings and parking lots and freeways.
All right. There are actually pictures in the book of a temple that was picked up and moved. Why and what happened to it?
Yes, this was the Sephardic temple. So Sephardim are Jews who have origins in the Middle East primarily and North Africa. And so this was a community, a small community, and they hoped to preserve their building. So they bought a new plot of land in the wake of renewal, and rather than having the building raised like everything else in the neighborhood, they decided to try to move it. And it was a hot summer day, and the building was loaded onto a truck bed, and the tires sank into the hot pavement, and the building cracked, and it was not reparable, so it had to be destroyed.
Wow. That's very symbolic, isn't it?
It certainly is, yes.
You get into population numbers from 1971, Ellen, this very time when the Jewish Community Center in Portland opens. Were Jews moving away or dying or no longer identifying as Jews? It seems like there might have been a few different dynamics then.
Yeah, it's interesting. When you look at that period of the 1960s up to the early 70s, what you see is a community that's trying to reinvent itself in certain ways, but is in many ways stagnant. The population had changed very little for decades. And there was some influx in, but there was also some influx out. And a community study at the time noted that a lot of the young adults are leaving, and that's certainly not what you want if you're hoping to preserve a community. And so there was a lot of concern and hand-wringing about that at the time. It's interesting, one of the things I point out at the beginning of that chapter is that it was interesting to see this building of the Jewish Community Center and of the synagogues in new locations. It was a very optimistic thing to do because it was not clear that the numbers would support these institutions at the time.
And ultimately, did they?
Ultimately, they certainly did. It was just after that the community started to see a huge surge, which is part of a larger surge of young college-educated adults coming to Oregon and to Portland in particular. And the community just grows in leaps and bounds. So by the early 1980s, there are approximately 10,000 Jews in Oregon. And then by the time you get about 15 or 20 years later, it's getting closer to 20,000. By the end of the century, it's about 25,000. And currently, the estimates range somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 to 48,000, something like that.
We're talking to Ellen Eisenberg about her book, The Jewish Oregon Story, 1950 to 2010. Let's go back to the earlier end of this range then, and give us a sense of what kinds of exclusions still existed, places that Jews were barred in the mid-20th century.
Yeah, in the mid-20th century, the exclusions came in a few different forms. So there were fraternities and sororities, both at the high school and college level, that didn't admit Jews. And in most of these cases, Jews then created sort of parallel structures. So they had, so Jewish teenagers had their own fraternities and sororities, and likewise in college. There were occupational restrictions. So the story that is most widely known and best documented is in the major Portland law firms. Many of them had Jewish partners back at the end of the 19th and early 20th centuries, but by the mid-20th centuries, they were not taking Jewish partners. Or Jewish associates. The same was true often in engineering and accounting firms, various professionals, and often medical practices as well. There were also exclusions at various social clubs and country clubs, that kind of thing. The Multnomah Athletic Club, for example, in Portland, didn't admit Jews.
Really? Okay. So there's a great story in here from Henry Blauer, who moved from New York City to Portland. How different was his connection to the Jewish community in those two places?
Yeah, that's a really interesting example, and I actually relate to it. I moved here from the East Coast, and I lived in Philadelphia immediately before coming to Salem. And living in a context like Philadelphia or New York City, there, if you're culturally Jewish and not necessarily religious, there are many ways in which one can feel Jewish, and there are lots of foods and cultural institutions and arts and so on. That one can be involved in. When one moves out here to make those connections, you almost have to join the community because it's not sort of part of the general atmosphere.
Okay. So,
and he talks about that he says that when he was living in New York, what they were trying to do was show that they were American. But when they came out here, there was no question that they were American, but they had to make an effort on the Jewish side to preserve that identity.
That's really interesting. It's almost a response to the culture around you.
Yeah.
Well, it is a response to the culture around you, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes.
So the next generation beyond the Henry Blowers, the Jewish boomer kids, I mean, how interested were they in being Jewish versus being American or Oregonian or any other identity?
Well, that becomes a difficult question to answer because what we see is just diversity in every single sense of the word and a lot more openness to different expressions of Judaism. So if you look at the scene now, and not just in Portland, but across the state, there's a really wide variety of institutions, of synagogue approaches, of groupings that are not formal synagogues. And there becomes a multiplicity of ways of expressing that Judaism. And also there's a lot more openness, inclusion, welcoming, for example, to families that may have a non-Jewish partner, to gays and lesbians, right, to a whole array of folks who might not have found a place in the Jewish community of 1950 or 1960.
We're talking to Ellen Eisenberg on the Jefferson Exchange. She's a professor of American history at Willamette University in Salem and the author of a new book called The Jewish Oregon Story, 1950 to 2010, which functions as a sequel to an earlier book she wrote about Jewish Oregonians from 1849 up to 1950. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. You might have some observations about the life of Jews in Oregon from the inside or from the outside. We'd like to hear from you. And your question or your comment, 800-838-3760, to join in by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. So we should talk about the fact that this is the same period in history when Oregon was getting a reputation as a haven for environmentalists. Talk about the influence of Dick Neuberger in all that.
Sure. Well, he's widely recognized, and he was a figure in Oregon politics in the 1950s. And he's widely recognized as one of the early environmentalists. Now, this was environmentalism in the form of kind of a more traditional conservation ethos than you would necessarily identify as environmentalist today. But he was one of the key figures, along with better-known figures like Tom McCall, for example, who began to shift the reputation of the state toward this more progressive environmental ethos for which it became known.
Conservation versus environmentalism being about protecting land and that sort of thing rather than
yeah, conservation has much more engagement in terms of use that will continue on to the future as opposed to solely preserving and preventing, for example, logging or something along that line.
All right, Neil Goldschmidt is also a key Jewish political figure here. First as Portland mayor, went on to become Secretary of Transportation under Jimmy Carter, came back and became Oregon governor. You say he represented a turn away from urban renewal as it had previously been known. To what?
Yeah, absolutely. To, I think, many of the things that we know Portland for today. So a good example of that is the debate that went on over the projects that came after this demolition of South Portland. So when the South Portland neighborhood was raised, when you drive over I-405 going into Portland, basically you're driving through that neighborhood, and part of it is where PSU is. Some of the later projects were much more oriented toward pedestrian use. So, for example, Pioneer Courthouse Square, Tom McCall Waterfront Park, bike trails, so making Portland the kind of city that it would be easy to walk in and bike in rather than orienting the city toward development for commuters to come in via car and have a lot of parking lots to service that.
So much less of a car-centric kind of environment.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So was Neil Goldschmidt an innovator there, or was he following what somebody else had laid out in advance?
Well, he was part of a coalition. So when he was elected to city council, he was a very young man. He was still in his 20s. He was regarded by the others on city council at that point as a bit of a hippie. And so he was sort of the beginning of this wave of politicians at that time. Vera Katz, of course, was also very known for her pedestrian-friendly policies and during her time in the State House for other kinds of progressive legislation. And they were in coalition, so to speak, with figures like McCall and the kinds of initiatives that he was making in terms of land use planning and so on. So with a much more focus on livability and environmentalism.
Neil Goldschmidt, Vera Katz, both Jews and Democrats. I'm reminded by your prose here that it was once possible to be Republican and Jewish. It doesn't seem that happens much anymore. Was that the case in Oregon, too?
Absolutely. If you go back to the early 20th century, most of the Jewish politicians were part of the Republican Party. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So Vera Katz, she's another interesting. It's interesting because both she and Neil Goldschmidt, in different trajectories, came through the Portland governor's office, and it seems like by the time that she got to be mayor, it was no longer an issue that you know there was not the as it still seems to get announced now, the first woman to do this, the first Jew to do that, and it seems like by the time Vera Katz got there, it wasn't an issue anymore.
As far as being the Jewish,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that the same is true for Neil Goldschmidt. By the time Neil Goldschmidt was mayor and certainly governor, that was no longer an issue. And actually, one of the things that I found in my research on the early part of the state is that goes all the way back to the foundings of the state. So there are many, many 19th century Oregon politicians, mayors, and whatnot, who do not really, being Jewish is not a big deal. They're elected as Oregonians who are also pioneers and successful business leaders and so on. It's not until the mid-20th century that you start to see, or the early to mid-20th century, that becomes a little more of an issue. So when Julius Meyer runs for governor, for example, there are a number of anti-Semitic attacks on him. But, of course, he wins the governorship easily.
I'm trying to remember when he got elected and where that was in time relation to when the Ku Klux Klan hit its apex in Oregon.
It was not long after. So the Klan, what they call the Klan legislature, was 1922 and Meyer's 1930. So it's not very long after, interestingly.
And I'm continuing.
Yeah, and he's elected as an independent. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a strange election. So the Republican candidate died during the campaign, and Republicans selected a new candidate. Meyer appears. He was a very close friend of the original candidate, and feels that the new Republican candidate is not kind of carrying the progressive torch of his friend, and so he becomes the independent candidate and is seen by many as the logical inheritor of that campaign, and he ends up getting more votes than the Democrat and the Republican combined.
Let's move from political figures to cultural figures. Ernest Bloch, who is he?
Well, he's a composer, and he fell in love with the Oregon coast. He's a very well-known composer of both Jewish and secular classical music. And he moves to the Oregon coast, and the bulk of probably about half of his repertoire is composed while in residence on the Oregon coast. And, of course, Newport, their music festival, is named for him.
So very influential there. Certainly the Schnitzer family name is emblazoned across Portland and a lot of cultural institutions. What were Arlene Schnitzer's motivations as she set things out in Portland?
Yeah, Arlene Schnitzer grew up the daughter of a furniture store owner. The Directors was her original family name, and her mother was in charge of the decoration department, the home decor department. And so presumably she picked up some of her artistic sensibilities and her eye from that. She actually gets involved in the arts more formally when she's a young wife and is looking for something to do. And so she enrolls in art classes and really falls in love with art, and then goes on to create her gallery in Portland. And of course, as the Schnitzer fortune grew, they became, I think, the most important benefactors of the arts in the state. So at this point, both they, Arlene and Harold Schnitzer, who's now deceased, and then their son, Jordan Schnitzer, for whom, for example, the University of Oregon Art Museum is now named. It was recently remodeled and redone and named for him.
And the Arlene Schnitzer
Concert Hall in Portland.
There's a whole bunch of other stuff out there. Right. So the Schnitzer name, again, emblazoned across Portland. Much more to talk about with Ellen Eisenberg. She is the author of The Jewish Oregon Story, 1950 to 2010, tracking the influence of Jews in Oregon in culture and politics and in so many other realms as well. A lot more left to talk about. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We'll come back and talk more with Ellen and take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Ellen Eisenberg, a history professor at Willamette University in Salem, American history specifically, and Oregon history even more specifically. She's the author of a new book called The Jewish Oregon Story, 1950 to 2010, published in part with assistance from the Oregon Jewish Museum and Center for Holocaust Education, and it does track the rise of Jews in Oregon and their influence politically, culturally, you name it, from 1950 to 2010. This is a conversation you're more than welcome to join with observations of your own or questions for the author. 800-838-3760 to join by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I was just musing about Julius Meyer, the Jewish man elected governor of Oregon in 1930. Notice that he served one term and that to date he is the only independent ever elected governor of Oregon.
That's correct. Yes. Right.
So an aside here, as we were talking about Arlene Schnitzer, this her influence, her rising influence came at a time of changing roles for women in the country. And I wonder if the struggle over women's roles played out maybe differently in Oregon's Jewish community.
I think it largely mirrored the general community. It was something that was very interesting to trace. And, of course, the added aspect of it is women's roles within the synagogue, which have changed very dramatically as a result of the women's movement. So I have a chapter in the book that focuses on women's roles, and I look at the stories of women personally in terms of the expectations for them as they were growing up in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and then the opportunities that opened to them. I look at women's organizations and the ways in which they shifted their focus. And then finally, I look within the synagogue walls. So in traditional Judaism, women and men play quite different roles, and that has really transformed very, very greatly over the last 50 years or so.
At all branches of Judaism, or primarily in Reform and Renewal.
In Reform, Renewal, Reconstructionist, and Conservative, and in for all intents and purposes, that's the vast majority of Jews in Oregon. We have a much smaller Orthodox community here in Oregon than would be the case in the rest of the country compared to national surveys, and certainly compared to places like New York. So the vast majority of congregations in Oregon are somewhere on the spectrum other than Orthodox. And in all of those other areas, women now play full roles in synagogue communities, in terms of leading services. Women are ordained rabbis and cantors and so on.
Is it full equality, or any barriers left? Any places that are still exclusively male in that domain?
Only within the Orthodox community. Mm-hmm. So women are not ordained within, and there are actually some movements pushing against that as well. There are some Orthodox seminaries that are more egalitarian in terms of gender, but the mainstream Orthodox movement has not accepted women as rabbis. But among the other branches, there is full equality.
I want to talk about some other influential Jews in Oregon in the time period that the book is covering. Harry Glickman is best known from the sports pages. What did he do?
He was instrumental in bringing the Blazers to Portland. So he's someone who grew up playing basketball at the in South Portland. He grew up in that neighborhood, and he was very interested in sports promotion. So before bringing the Blazers to Portland, he for a while was the owner of a hockey team, and he promoted various other sporting events, the Harlem Globetrotters visits to Portland, that kind of thing. And then, of course, the Blazers. And so he was the person who was instrumental in making that happen in Portland.
You mentioned that he came from South Portland, which brings us back to that community again, multiple visits here. And it seems like in some senses, South Portland is larger in death than it was in life.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And one of the most interesting things, my actual favorite document from the archives that I found was a musical that was written about South Portland just after its demise. And it was an original musical with 23 songs that was performed at the Jewish Community Center just as that community was being raised and the new center was being built. And it memorialized the community, but it also became larger than life. And it combined these memories of South Portland, of particular bagel bakeries or delis and whatnot, and kind of infused them with a combination of the Lower East Side of New York and Fiddler on the Roof. And so that became, in many ways, the memory of South Portland, that it had been somehow a more Jewish, more traditional, almost more old world place than it was in real life.
And it was called Whatever Happened to Old South Portland?
That was the name of the musical, yes.
Has it been performed much over the years? Is it the kind of thing that gets revived every so often?
No, I would love to see that happen. It was a one-time thing, and it was very popular. It was written up in the Oregonian and the other secular press as well as in the Jewish press. But it's never, to my knowledge, been performed again. But I do have the script, so if anyone wants to take a stab at it.
Are there royalties attached to it?
Not that I know of.
Okay. You could help Ellen get this on stage. The nostalgia thread that you were just talking about, back to the Lower East Side of New York City, the way you describe it in the book, it sounds almost like a sense of the old country.
Yes. Yeah, very much so. And I think, remember, this is the early 1970s. And there is a real ethnic revival nationally in the 1960s and 70s. So in the 1950s, you know, we think about people trying to blend in and be almost sort of invisible ethnically. By the 1960s and 70s, ethnicity is something that is increasingly publicly celebrated. And, you know, you go to any downtown area in the summer and there is an Italian festival one week and a Finnish festival the next week and so on. These are products of the 1960s and 70s, and the Jewish community was taking part in that. And in some ways in the Jewish community, it was even more urgent in some sense, because this is a generation that's coming to a realization that Jewish identity is to a large degree on them. The Jewish community in the United States after the Holocaust is the largest Jewish community in the world. And so there's this new sense of responsibility for preserving and a sort of romanticism of the historical roots.
I wonder then if whatever happened to Old South Portland was part of a trend or a booster to it. I mean, when you talk about in the same chapter the creation of Jewish historical organizations, I mean, can you trace a direct line from the musical to those, or is it more just part of the same tide?
No, it's part of the same tide, but there is a direct line in that the person who was most responsible for the musical, her name was Shirley Tanzer. And she became very interested in oral history. She initially started conducting oral histories just to gain information for the purpose of writing the musical. But then the oral histories took on a life of their own, and she began the Jewish Oral History Project in Portland, which to date has recorded something like 500 oral histories, and not just in Portland, but well beyond Portland. And that collection of histories is one of the things that spurred the creation of the Jewish Historical Society of Oregon, which in turn, of course, became the Oregon Jewish Museum. And because the musical was so popular, when they had the musical, it was followed by a series of exhibits and so on that really increased that interest and that nostalgia for Old South Portland.
Despite this upwelling of feeling, though, it sounds like there was still opposition to things like the creation of a Holocaust memorial in Portland. What happened there?
Yes. Well, I think that there was a general, certainly within the Jewish community, there was a great desire to create a Holocaust memorial. And there were a number of survivors who came to Portland, and they were centrally involved in these efforts. But there was some pushback within the city, especially about the location. So there were some neighbors of the various locations proposed who didn't want to live down the street from a Holocaust memorial. And so there was some pushback on that front.
What was the problem with living down the street from a Holocaust memorial?
I think that the neighbors, and certainly not all of them, but those who voiced these opinions felt, well, one of them I quote in the book who said it would be a downer, right, that this would be kind of a depressing thing to see when one walked up the street.
Ah, okay. Let's talk about some other aspects of Portland Jewish life or Oregon Jewish life in the 60s. Portland Jews, in a notice in 1964, called for school desegregation. How big a change was that for the Jewish community to make that take that position?
Yeah, that was really interesting. So Jewish communities in America in general have tended to be on the liberal/progressive end of the spectrum, particularly on issues of civil rights. And of course, mostly they explain that by virtue of their own experience with prejudice and discrimination. And so there was a strong sense in the Jewish community nationally by the early to mid-20th century that the way to fight anti-Semitism was to fight all forms of discrimination. And that was certainly true in the Portland Jewish community. However, at mid-century, when there was still a lot of quite strong prejudice in Portland itself, and Jews were still facing that discrimination, there was a reluctance to speak up about local issues. So in the 40s and 50s, you find Jews in Oregon speaking up about civil rights in the South, right? But they're a little reluctant to challenge local norms and local practices at a time when there was still not official Jim Crow in Portland, but certainly there was a lot of widespread discrimination against African Americans and restrictions. By the time you get to the 1960s, you see a real change there. And so Jews in Portland become extremely outspoken, not just on the national issues, but also on the local issues. And I think that that's a matter of the community becoming much more confident in its own acceptance and in its ability to speak out and take a leadership role on this.
So as you pointed out long ago in this discussion, 1967 was a key year for Jews across the country with the Six-Day War between Israel and Egypt. I mean, how did the war in Israel shake things up here and realign them?
Yeah, 1967, the Six-Day War, and of course we're coming up on the 50th anniversary this spring, is considered a major turning point. It was a moment, and of course it wasn't just Egypt, but it was all of the Arab countries surrounding Israel, and it was really a kind of existential crisis for Israel and by extension for Jewish communities worldwide, a real realization and fear that Israel could be destroyed and that therefore their place of potential refuge could be destroyed. And then the Israeli victory ends up becoming at that time a great point of pride among Jews. It was kind of seen by Jewish communities as almost a David and Goliath. And of course, as we'll see, as the war is commemorated in the spring, of course, interpretations of that have changed dramatically since then. But at the time, that was very much how it was seen. And it was a riveting event for Jewish communities around the world. And perhaps, adding to that in Portland was the strange coincidence that the two rabbis of the two largest congregations in Portland both happened to be on sabbatical in Israel with their families. And so they were sending home their own accounts. Rabbi Rose of Temple Beth Israel was in Tel Aviv, and Rabbi Stamfer of Neve Shalom was in Jerusalem. And so they're sending home their own accounts of their experiences during the war.
Oh, wow. So that must have gotten a bit riveting for the folks back in Portland.
Absolutely. Of course, there are lags in all of this, so they're sending home letters that then get published a week or two later. But yes.
So give us a sense then, because obviously things are not as united as they were back then in feelings about Israel, within American politics certainly, but I wonder if it's that much more intense within a Jewish community in Oregon or in anywhere, discussions about whether the approach to dealing with the Palestinians is the right one between members of organizations here.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So back in the 1960s and 70s, up until the first Intifada, which takes place in the 1980s, the Palestinian uprising, up to that point, there's a very unified pro-Israel opinion among American Jews. And it's around that time of the first Intifada, of the Lebanon War, also in the early 1980s, that some people on the left end of the spectrum start to question Israel's treatment of the Palestinians, start to advocate for a two-state solution, and so on. Mainstream Jewish organizations maintained their policy of supporting the Israeli government and kind of saying, it's not our role as American Jews to tell them what to do. We need to support the Israeli government, which is a democratically elected government, and let them make their decisions. But as we get into the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, there are increasing numbers of American Jews who would identify as progressive or left on these questions, and they start to question this. And here in Oregon, where we have a more liberal demographic, I think that's one of the things that has attracted people to Oregon in the last 20 or 30 years. And of course, Oregon, at least the sections where the Jewish population is concentrated, is an extremely blue state. And so I think there's more of that sentiment here, and you see that play out in the pages of the Jewish press here in Oregon.
All right, we've gone through the pages of the book, The Oregon Jewish Story, 1950 to 2010. Ellen Eisenberg wrote it and joined us on The Exchange today. Ellen, thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
All right, take care.